The following podcast is brought to you exclusively by the R&R Podcast Network. Welcome to RTW Rewind. Red Rob will take you on a journey through time to relive some of the greatest moments, matches, and personalities from the sport of professional wrestling. Now, here's your host of the show, Red Rob, Rob Francois.
Hey guys, welcome back to RTW Rewind. I have a very, very special guest today. Unfortunately, some of you newer wrestling fans may not know about this man, but since this is a retro podcast, and if you're listening, you're most likely a fan of the 80s and 90s like I was, this guy doesn't get enough credit for doing what he did and putting people over. He was considered an enhancement talent, but he's much, much more than that. He is former WWF superstar, Mr. Dusty Wolf, sometimes known as Dale Wolf, but we'll get into that. How's it going, Dusty?
I guess it's pretty much over now. I don't think I can follow that intro, so I appreciate it. I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm good. I'm good, man. I'm glad to have you here.
All right. Thank you.
So, you know, I have a love for wrestling. I've been watching for 30-plus years, and I remember watching you from the old days back on, you know, Wrestling Challenge, WWF Superstars. Did you grow up a wrestling fan when you were a kid?
Yes. Yeah. If I say anything different, I'm lying. I didn't even know wrestling existed until I was like 6, 7 years old. And somewhere in there. And the little bit of time I had around my dad as a kid, before he left home, he loved roller derby.
Okay.
You know, in the late 60s, I'm dating myself now. Like, people can't do the math anyway, right? But in the late 60s through the mid 70s, roller derby and wrestling were on together on your local TV stations. You know, one followed the other. It was like a package deal. It was like the syndication, the way they did the syndication. So anyway, he insisted on watching roller derby. And then just one day, I can't remember if it was before or after the roller derby, I caught wrestling. I'm like, hey, this is great. This is better than roller derby, Dad. And he left home soon after. But from that point on, I watched wherever I got a chance. Yeah, I read the magazines. I was a fan. I'm not going to ever tell anybody differently.
Now, I mean, what made you make the decision that you wanted to get into the business?
I had played baseball. And then I got sick and lost. I couldn't pass physical again, is what it was. Mm-hmm. I never had anything to, but I couldn't even pass physical in order for them to say, okay, you can play back on a high school team. So I graduated high school at a young age, and I had a good job, and then I quit the good job, and I was like 18, and I had been going to college a little bit, and I said, you know what, I'm not going to like myself much if I don't try to wrestle. I can do this. I want to do this. And I had convinced myself that I could always go back to college. There'd be another job if it didn't work out. You know, because like I said, I was only 18 when I started.
Right.
And I didn't go back to college again until I was 47. So, I mean, I got started trying. It just, even with all the highs and the lows, I was there for another almost 30 years.
I mean, that's quite a long run. And, you were trained by Ken Johnson, correct?
Yeah, here in San Antonio. Worked with him for, I want to say, close to a year, maybe a little less. Probably closer to 10 months. And I got my first match simply because we went to get permission to train in the ring there at the Junction here in San Antonio, you know, once, twice a week, because there was no ring. There's not like everybody owns a ring on every corner nowadays. In those days, it's the only like one or two rings in town. And so we went in, and they're like, well, we need somebody to do a job tonight. And that was me, because I had never been seen before. And from that point forward, Joe Blanchard put me with Don Carson, and then Kenny and Don Carson, and I trained with both of them for about another 6 months and had the odd occasional TV match.
You made your WWF debut in, I think, 1987. How did you get hooked up with them?
Well, I had worked with Terry Garvin in Kansas City in 84, and he'd left by 85. But I knew Terry Garvin. I was on my way home from working in Hawaii for Liam Avila, and then I was in the LA airport, and I picked up one of the payphones in those days, for the kids who don't know what those are. Yeah. And I called the office there in Connecticut, and I asked for Terry, and he got on the phone, and he says, can't really offer you a lot. And I'm, you know, if you're paying more, and I told Terry then on the phone at the airport, if you're paying what I hear you're paying, you know, one night's more than what I'm making out here some of these places in a week. And that's when I'm there. What do you want me? And I was in either Vegas and then Phoenix or Phoenix and then Vegas. But you get the idea. It was the 2 days in a row. Yeah. So I stuck through at a buddy's house for a couple more days and started a couple. That was it. It was a phone call to Terry Garvin. That was how I started.
You know, I had a conversation. I was chatting with Barry Horowitz this morning on Facebook, and he's going to come on here in a few weeks. And I told him I was going to have a chat with you today, and he really, you know, he really put you over as a great worker.
Well, Barry's probably the most underrated, underutilized worker in my time period.
Yeah.
There's other guys that, well, Brad Armstrong's probably the only other one that you could put at that level. Barry was tremendous talent. It just, he was like me. He was, I don't want to say too easy going, but too happy to be where we were at, making the money we didn't put. And it was hard for a guy like Barry or myself that are, you know, 5'10", 5'11", to get a huge push in the land of the Giants, which it was in those days. It really was. Yeah. So, I mean, Barry earned everything he ever had, too. So it's not ever let anybody tell you different.
Barry, I mean, he's a super nice guy, and he said pretty much the same thing you did. I mean, the money was too good to pass up. Sure, you could stay local and be the top guy and get paid peanuts for 50 people a night, or you could be on, you know, national television, eventually worldwide television, making really good money, and, you know, you're putting people over. Like, I use this analogy. If you treat it as a job, like I do, you know, just going to work, doing the best you can, wins and losses didn't matter. You were doing your job and getting paid well for it, and you got nationwide recognition. Did you have a problem with being an enhancement guy?
No, the checks cashed, and the checks never bounced.
Right.
You know, and I could never go to the grocery store and say, hey, I won this week, or here's my title belt from Podunk, Kentucky. Let's pay my extra. I couldn't do that. But I could certainly take that cash and, you know, take. I had one son at the time, and, you know, take care of him and keep the lights on, that sort of thing. So, no, I never had an issue with it. I never did. I never had an issue with the idea of doing it until I'd already retired. And the people are like, well, because you did jobs in 1987, you must be dumb.
Yeah,
you know, that's the time I ever had a problem with it, really, truly, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, look, man, I would love to be the position you were in. You know, just growing up a wrestling fan, I wouldn't care if I was, you know, putting over Hulk Hogan or putting over Rick Rude or whoever else. I mean, you literally got to work with the best in the wrestling business. I mean, you had a really great job.
Well, you know, I had the four or five years in the territories before I ever went there.
Right.
And then I went there, and a couple times I went into Puerto Rico and worked with some guys that were, you know, top names there in and around my time with Vince. And then when I left Vince, I went to Atlanta, overseas. There's only a handful of guys from that generation that you would say top talent. I didn't, even if it was a 3-4 minute match and we were out of there, I was in the ring with them. And a lot of them, I had more than that with them elsewhere, like Kansas City or overseas or whatever, because the cameras weren't rolling.
RTW Rewind.
I mean, it's a lost art. Obviously, you don't have, I mean, there are some enhancement matches now on Raw and SmackDown, but really, I mean, with the syndicated shows, that's how people got over, you know?
It's the only way you could. You had 46 minutes with time, of airtime for the show itself, and if you give, and they've seen this, they've done it to themselves, if you give away too much competitive on TV for free, you lose the incentive as far as the fan goes to go pay for anything, whether it's pay-per-view or in the building.
Yeah.
They've done it to themselves. I understand it had to get a little more competitive as time went on, but where's that limit? Where's that line?
Right. Yeah. No, I totally get it. And who were some of your favorite guys to work with?
Oh, the workers. Hennig, Tito, Martel, Barry. We talked about Barry. Barry was great to work with. Owen. If you go through the list of it and you know that they were, I loved it because I learned from them all. Jake, you know, guys saying they're all different styles, but I learned from all of them. I learned something from Murdoch, even though I never worked with Murdoch in the WWF. One of the different independents, and then, you know, Tully. Tully had a horrible reputation, but Tully is a person, but Tully could teach you how to work, and he did. You know, the Sweepers, they taught me a lot as far as who to work with. Guys like that, you know, the guys that you know more talent because they always made me work harder.
Right. Were there anybody that you didn't enjoy working with?
You need the big stiff muscle heads that didn't have a clue.
Right.
List. Those guys were horrible because I never had the physique. I was never going to have the physique because I wasn't going to. Part of the time I was a little lazy, and then the rest of the time I wasn't going to do the steroids required. So, I mean, I wasn't going to be a big muscle head guy. I had to learn how to do something in the ring psychological. And these guys, it was horrible. And even the ones that meant well, they're just so strong. And you couldn't have a match because you were busy defending yourself.
Right.
So you can go through that entire list. There's not any of that list. The steroid. Rude would be the only exception. Rude was of the guys that came out of that kind of clique that could actually work, and you didn't have to defend yourself every second of the night that you were in there with him.
Right.
He's the only one I can think of, truthfully.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at, you know, when you're going against heels and they're, you know, pretty much squash matches, I mean, a lot of that stuff looked really, really stiff. And, you know, I don't know if as many people took liberties with you, but there was a lot of other enhancement guys that just got the living piss beat out of them. And you could tell, too.
That's a respect issue, too. Not to toot my horn, those guys knew that if they had to go out there and do 10, 15 with me, that they could.
Yeah.
There's those guys that just you know, kick the air and shit out of them. They couldn't get 5, 10, 20 out of those guys. And it was a respect thing for the older guys. The younger guys, when I say younger than I am, the ones that came along in the late 80s and early 90s, a lot of them were never taught anything like that about respect. You know, that you don't have, you're nobody unless you have somebody to work with. And they were never taught any of that. So. Yeah.
I mean, it's funny, like, you know, I only saw you on, you know, like I said, Superstars and Challenge and stuff like that. But all these years later, I remembered who you were. I mean, you know, guys like you, guys like Barry, guys like Iron Mike Sharp or, you know, Tom Stone. It's like, you know, you still remember those names nowadays.
That speaks to how big Vince McMahon's product was in the 80s.
Yeah.
Tells you, you know, a guy like me that I got my hand raised once in like 500 matches with Vince.
That's right. What? Yeah.
And that's because the lights went out in the building and they had to fix the lights. And I was like, you know, go out there right now. Legit. But people still remember us. And yeah, they don't remember guys from 10 years ago.
True.
That's not a testament to necessarily, well, it is a little bit to the talent, but that's just how ingrained Vince became in society in the 80s. I've seen it come full circle to where it's not anywhere near what it was then, if it makes sense. Yeah. It was just like, it was just a part of society. Everybody watched it. Everybody knew what was going on with Vince. Even if they didn't admit it, they knew. Because you have people that go, oh, I don't watch wrestling, and then they would do the, oh, yeah, or something like that. You know?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so it was just how big it was. It really was. It was unbelievable.
Did you have a lot of interactions or any interactions with Vince? What was he like to work for?
Not a lot. Vince has the layers of insulation. The times that I did talk to him or deal with him, he treated Vince kept me around for 6 years when he had no reason to.
Right.
I know all the bad stories and some that haven't been told. And there's some that have come along since, and I don't know. But, I mean, you don't become a billionaire. You're not Trump's best friend if you don't have a dark side to you. It's there.
Yeah.
But as far as my personal interactions, I have no complaints. He took better care of me than he ever had reason to.
Right, yeah. Who was running the crew when you were there? Who was running a TV crew on taping days?
Pat was always the booker when I was there.
Yeah.
Terry Garvin was in charge of the refs and TVs and so on when I started. Tony Greer when I left because of the Rainboy scandal. And then right under them, JJ came in like halfway through my time there. Stolen was always involved with the TVs. That was the brand trust as far as the TVs go.
You know, back in the day, I know it was obviously run differently from the way it is today, but even back then, compared to what you were used to, how professional was that company compared to any other places you worked at?
Much more. Yeah. I mean, you know, whether it was here in San Antonio at the Junction or Florida at their Sportatorium, Memphis at the TV station. The TVs up to this point had been, well, they still were as far as it is, just nothing more than that commercial, that hour-long commercial for your house shows.
Right.
But the promoters, especially in the territories, you know, they scrimped. They didn't spend any money on a TV production. You dressed in a lounge in Memphis, and then you went to the studio that sort of thing. Or the Junction here in San Antonio was an old converted plumbing company that they put 500 seats in, and that's by stacking bleachers on top of each other.
Right.
And, you know, the TV buildings were horrible. In a lot of cases, they were horrible. Not always. But then you had, you know, two camera setups. Whereas first time you walked out for Vince, you realize there's like 50 cameras. And
right.
Light. And he was just beginning to get into the pyro and that sort of thing. And so it was light years ahead of anything that I had been around, whether, like I say, whether it's Puerto Rico or Memphis or San Antonio, Dallas, any of those places. It was light years ahead.
Now, you mentioned Memphis, and obviously Jerry Jarrett was famous for, well, I don't know, maybe his lack of payoffs.
Well, when I was there, Jerry Jarrett's a businessman. He's a Welch. Whether he's by birth or not, he's a Welch. He learned from Welches. Okay, I've heard both stories, so I'm not going to say, but he might as well be a Welch the way he promotes. when I was there, he was paying fairly well for what we were doing. He quit paying when there was no options for the talent. You know, you have no place to go. I pay you whatever I want to pay you. And he did become, okay, my computer keeps going. He did become what he's been claimed. He did become that, you know, $30, $40 a night. But the boys had no options when they had on. Because when we were there, me and Ken Towns were there as the blondes, as the Hollywood blondes. I was as green as a gourd. I was too green for Memphis at the time. Looking back, you know, just to be honest, I was. But they had plans to do a little something with us. It may not have been major, but they had plans to keep us a little while. And Jerry Jarrett pulls us into the back of the South Coliseum, hands us a check for them. The check was like $600 for the week. Because then it says, don't leave, the money's down, the money will get better. So if you do that 84 money today, that's, what, $1,700?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah. So, I mean, the Jerry Jarrett I dealt with in 84 for a couple months, no, he was probably cheap, he was probably stealing from all of us, but it wasn't $40 a night like it was just, what, 5 years later, 6 years later? But supply and demand, he had 1,000 wrestlers and 12 spots.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I mean, just you hear stories, you know, like Steve Austin having to eat, you know, cans of tuna and raw potatoes because the payouts were that bad. Yeah,
those stories are true. They're not exaggerated because I had friends that were there at the time. Obviously, you know, not just Austin, but they passed through during that time period, and they're all telling me, oh, "He's only paying me." And I'm like, "How are you surviving? We're not."
Yeah.
You know, we're doing better out there on the indie scene. But he had the connection to Vince. He had the connection. Jarrett was always respected with Vince. And depending on who was in Atlanta, he always had an in to Atlanta. So he was like a proving ground almost.
Yeah. How was it like working for Fritz down in World Class?
I enjoyed it. I didn't have a problem with it. Brody booked me in, and I was there for about 5-6 months. And when Brody lost the book and Gary Hart took the book over, I was done. That's the same time I went to Vince, so I wasn't heartbroken. Yeah. But it's close to home. I mean, so even if the territory was down compared to what it had been just a couple years ago, I was close to home. I wasn't having to support an apartment in one part of the country and send money home in another, that sort of thing. So it wasn't bad for me. You knew what the Von Erich boys were up to. You knew what it was about. You just went in and made your money.
Yeah. I mean, I remember watching when I had an ESPN deal, I'd come home from school and watch, you know, the Legends of the World Class. And you want to talk about the guys that came through that system. I mean, it's a who's who. And, you know, obviously you're one of them, but what was the reason for their downfall? Was it, you know, losing his kids or losing his top talent? What do you think put World Class out of business? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. A combination of things. Vince started to take over. The boys themselves being unreliable. Mm-hmm. The drug problems and then, unfortunately, the deaths. And even when they were still doing a little bit of business, the Kerry loses the foot. It wasn't just one thing. Every territory that dropped like they did, they had Vince putting on. And then at the same time, Crockett, too. And Crockett did a lot of stab backs and cut throats. Crockett didn't help him. Vince obviously didn't help him. And I'm going to say just the idea that the boys were being exposed for what they were. And not just the boys. You had Chris, a couple other people getting arrested for assaulting airline attendants and things like that at the same time. And it was just like I said, just one layer after another. And the last one would have been when Kerry lost the foot. There was no coming back after that as far as any kind of major anything. Because Vince had spent the past – not Vince, I'm sorry. Fritz had spent the last, 5 years building the entire territory around the boys. Now there's no boys.
Yeah, true. And a lot of his top talent, you know, his other top talent left to go to, you know, either Crockett's or Vern or, you know, or Vince.
Had to.
Yeah.
They went over to watch. Just they could stay home and go to work and double and triple the money they had been making. They had to. I was there at the very in fact, I was scheduled to be Mike Von Erich's last. Well, I was scheduled to be Mike Von Erich's opponent the night he killed himself.
Oh wow!
I mean, that's the time period I was there.
Yeah.
It was not completely dead then. You know, the sportatorium was still okay. Some of the spot shows were still okay. Fort Worth had started to die off, that sort of thing. That's when I was there.
So when you got to the WWF, did you enjoy the travel schedule they had? How many nights did you actually, how many dates did you work for them on a normal year?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I had good years to where when I first went in, I had day after day. It was 40, 50 days before I had a day off. And then there was times I didn't, especially when they started having trouble in 90, 91, there was times where I didn't work for them for, 6 weeks, a month. And in fact, one time in 91, I went to Puerto Rico for 2 months. I just, there's nothing going on. The scandals are happening. I went to Puerto Rico. I let the office know I'm going to Puerto Rico. They called me and they offered me X amount of dollars per week. And I haven't seen anything out of you in the last 3 weeks. And I'm looking at the booking sheet coming up in Canada and the old territory, you know, the Northeast. And you're not flying people very much right this moment. And then when they survived all that, I came back to Puerto Rico. I was back. It's hard to say. I mean, there was a couple of years there where I probably was on the road 150, 200 days out of the year with them. And that's just considered part time. I never had an official deal. I never had a handshake deal. None of that. The worst year I probably had was probably 7,500 days.
What's going on, everybody? My name is Vampiro. This right here is the Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast. Tune in, get tuned up, get informed, and enjoy the podcast.
RTW Rewind.
So, with the rest of the days, what were you doing with your free time?
Independence.
Yeah,
I had no paper. I mean, nobody had paper, and I never put paper, so it wasn't like I was going to kill anything they were doing with me. And mm-hmm. I would work for the Independence. I would go overseas if I knew I had a week, or I knew like WrestleMania. When WrestleMania, and then you would have the 2 or 3 weeks, and there was nothing was going to happen for me then. I would go overseas, or I would take a trip, you know, out west for a guy that was running 3 or 4 days, and I worked for anybody. That was just it. I worked for any and everybody, even during the time where I was, you know, as close to full time as you could get for them. Every time I was on my days off, I was working somewhere else. I knew it would end. I knew it would end. In fact, I figured it would end like half the time that I got out of them.
Right.
So I never quit going where anybody would call me as long as I could make it. And I would make, like I said, I'd make business 100, 150, whatever, 200 days a year. And if I had the time, and I had the time off, I'd go make somebody else's dates too. Because I might, as far as my mind worked, I may need them next month.
Yeah.
Right now, I don't really need them, but I can never make too much money.
True. You know, might as well get it while the getting's good, right?
Exactly.
Now, were you able to get more bookings than you normally would because you had that exposure from the WWF?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about today. I knew in those days it was, you know, once you're on that TV, there's guys that are still getting bookings that are, you know, even older than I am, that are still getting bookings. At one time, we had a formula figured out. You could get top dollar when you left Vince's TV. You could get top dollar for like a year. Yeah. On the independent scene. And then for every 6 months after that, it would drop about 15% to where you could, you know, you'd still make some money, but you weren't making that top dollar after about 2 years.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't do anything but help you. I mean, it's DTV.
I mean, I still think that plays today. I mean, a lot of the guys and girls that get released, you know, they're known worldwide, and I'm sure they have no problem getting independent bookings now. So, you know, in fact, it probably plays more so today. How were you treated in the locker room? Did the guys respect you?
For the most part, I knew a lot of them before I ever got there.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been in Dallas and San Antonio, Florida, Puerto Rico, Memphis, you know, so I knew a lot of them before I ever got there. And I also was one of those that I don't want to say, well, I knew my role, but I did.
Yeah,
I was a wrestler just like them, but I also wasn't the moneymaker like them. So I always had that attitude, and that helped. And it was reality, though. I wasn't the moneymaker. I was the carpenter. I was the support system.
Yeah.
So I treated myself like that, and they, for the most part, respected me like that. I'm sure there's a guy or two here and there that if we were to go really deep, we'd find out they'd big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. How are guys, you know, managing is a lost art today. How is it to work with and to watch guys work like Bobby Heenan and Jimmy Hart and guys like that?
What about them?
How is it like watching them work? And I mean, those are guys that are, you know,
Bobby was somebody to learn from.
That's what I'm saying. Like he was absolutely respected by everybody.
Yeah. Even if Bobby was like Piper, less is best.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew how to get more done psychologically than a lot of guys will ever realize. And just watching him was a lesson a lot of nights. Just the little nuances.
Yeah.
And then he would take the big bump. Boom. And they're like, oh, my God, they killed him.
Right.
And one big bump where they killed him, it meant so much because of the little things. Bobby was great to learn from like that. Jimmy, I like Jimmy, but Jimmy was not an education like Bobby was. Mm-hmm. Bobby was the best when it comes to ringside management, or one of the best.
Jimmy was, I mean, and Bobby was great at getting heat, but Jimmy was pretty good at being annoying and getting the fans to hate him. Yeah.
Yeah, like he, but by the time he got to Vince did something to them and softened it. Neutered, I don't want to say neutered it, but definitely softened it or sanded off some edges or something. Memphis, Jimmy was a heat magnet.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that firsthand. It was unbelievable what was in Memphis, what was in Vince. It's not even the same guy.
Wow, I'm not too familiar with his early work. You know, I just know him from, you know, WWF and WCW. But, you know, he obviously was charismatic. He was obviously a great talker. But I'll have to go back and see if I can find some old footage of him, you know, back then to see what he was really like.
Jimmy was so hot in Memphis, he could take a guy that was like a slug in the ring and talk people into the seats with this slug and Lawler, because they just knew eventually Lawler was going to get his hands on Jimmy.
Yeah.
Jimmy was over.
Yeah. And Jerry, to his credit, was over too. I mean,
I've never liked him personally, but as far as he printed money in Memphis for a few years.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and obviously it helps when you're the booker too, but.
Yeah, because I can make myself God, but right. And he did. But he backed it up, unlike some of the guys that go that route. He actually did back it up for about a 4 or 5 year period. I mean, really, literally, it was, I mean, I've been sold out every night, but it was a moneymaker every Monday night.
Yeah, and I mean, he could talk people into the building, and he can get anybody, you know, anybody to get to mad at him. And he was a great face as well. Like, you know, whenever he made the eventual turn, I mean, he was over like nobody else. But he's had a pretty good run. I mean, you got to give him some credit for
unbelievable. If nothing else, you got to give him credit for surviving like he did and making what he made that long and then doing what he did. And I say personally, I have no use for it, but professionally, it's like Jesus. I would have had half of that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I miss a lot of the old guys, like, you know, like Bobby Heenan and guy Gorilla Monsoon. I mean, you want to talk about a guy that knew how to put people over, you know, with his commentary for being a
put himself over. That's if you look back, there was a whole lot of times Gorilla was getting Gorilla over.
Really,
and I've always said Gorilla was overrated. That's just me. Mm-hmm. I've always put Sully at the top of the list.
Okay.
Steve Stack down here in San Antonio. We didn't get along personally a lot of times either, but he was good at what he did. Lance Russell in Memphis. Gorilla to me is just a perfect example of what I said. Vince's TV became so ingrained in American culture that the youth of that time period, the 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, the 15-year-olds, Gorilla was loud. Gorilla was bombastic. He had Heenan.
True.
I'll never forget he had Heenan.
Yeah.
And he got over being big and loud and bombastic. Not necessarily got over because, in my opinion, he was that good.
And he had Jesse as well, and Jesse was great at getting beat, too.
Yeah, so I forgot about Jesse. But, yeah, at times he did.
Yeah. But you're right about, you know, guys like Lance Russell. I mean, I could listen to him for days. Bob Caudle was another one that I loved.
Good. I was not exposed to him a lot, but, yes, a little bit I saw, he was good. Yes.
And obviously Jim Ross. Jim Ross knew how to get the talent over as well, and is still having a great run.
Jim was younger, better, but Jim's still good.
Yeah,
I couldn't do what he does. So,
me neither. And I like to talk, but I mean, it takes a special talent to hit your marks, to know what you're doing, to know what the storyline is, to know what the creative is, and to get people over. Yes. Yeah, yes. It's definitely a craft that not everybody can do for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Do you watch anything nowadays or not at all?
I quit about Tom Rock in Hollywood. because it was him, but to me that's kind of like that was a turning point period with everything. Everything. And I have tried a few times along the way to watch like Impact or whatever they call themselves today. And I can't get to a full show. Yeah. I watched the Raw reunion thing here. Was it 2 years ago now?
I think so, yeah.
I watched that. It's the last time I watched the full show, and that was the first time in years. I can't. Well, first of all, I don't have anything invested anymore because I'm not going to be anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. It's the fan has gone. I'm broken down and old, and I've paid my dues and all that. So, I mean, that part's just – that flame's gone. But as far as saying, I want to watch the new generations, whatever, they don't do anything I recognize.
Yeah.
They don't do anything to catch my attention, even though I 100% of all people know what's going on.
Right.
I can still be interested in just to see how it plays out, and they don't do it anymore. They don't do. They just go out there and they bounce around like a video game.
It's true. It's a different style. It is. I mean, and I know the business has to adapt.
And they do the Superman land. And then,
right.
And I'm like, yeah. That would be okay if one of you did it.
Yeah. No, I get it. I mean, back in the day when a small package is beating somebody or, you know, like a, you know, or a Sunset Flip and, yeah, you know, Jake the Snake, you know, is knocking everybody out with his DDT. And now a DDT is just a high spot.
It's just another high spot, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's true. I get it. But
part of good wrestling is the psychology, the story that's going with it. That's part of good wrestling. That's what it is. And then people would say, and there was plenty of bad in the old days. There was plenty of bad.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to tell you different. There were guys that had no business being in the ring. But the guys that were good. And they knew how to draw the fan. And they knew how to. And even if you were one of the boys watchers from the curtain, they knew how to make you watch. So what are they going to do next?
Right.
How are you going to follow this? To where if a guy's just kicked out of 15 destroyers of some sort, well, there's nothing to follow.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's just, you know, the business has to adapt at some point. But I don't know why psychology still doesn't work nowadays. I mean, that's what hooked guys, you know, like
that's
me.
So exposed. The business is so exposed. Nobody today, even the 9-year-old, 10-year-old ringside, nobody today doesn't understand that whatever the psychology that you or I were used to, whatever we know is psychology, it's all from the office.
Right.
They know it. It's all from the office. So why bother? You know, why would I get all worked up over it? Because if I get mad, I'm just going to complain to the office that I'm mad about it. The office will issue an apology and it's over.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's why business is down and why ratings are down. And you know, even from, say, the late 90s and the whole Attitude Era thing, you know, when wrestling was hot again, you know, you get away from compelling storylines and compelling characters where everybody can have a 5-star match now. There's not enough to draw me in as a wrestling fan to keep me captivated. You know, I can go watch anything. I can go watch, you know, something on Netflix.
Yeah, well, there's a whole list of 5-star matches. If I just keep giving you 5-star matches, and I don't even like the rating system, but I'm using it as an example, meaning if I went out there on a card, let's say in Boston, and I'm going to do a couple arm drags or drop kick, and then I'm going to grab a hold because it's not my job to go out there and go to the floor and drop something off the top rope and all. It's not my place. It's my place to set the table. It's my place to get you ready. Still have a solid match so you're not leaving the building.
Yeah.
When the guys that do drop the elbows and when they do go to the floor, it means so much more. And that's part of the psychology that is gone. Everybody has to perform for today in the moment. And I have to top the guy. And I'm like, ah. You know, we can talk all we want. It's not going backwards.
No, it's definitely not going to go backwards ever. Yeah. And it's unfortunate. And I guess guys like us are going to be dinosaurs at some point. And it's just, I mean,
When I was breaking in, the old guys were like, why are you wearing knee pads? Because I leave my feet.
Right.
You know, Sonny Myers, I leave my feet. You work 60 minutes on your ass. And, you know, so there is a generational thing there.
Yeah, no, there is for sure. I mean, sometimes I try to be not as critical and I try to suspend my disbelief and try to be a fan again. But, man, I'm telling you, it's hard. It's really, especially when I have to review this because I have a podcast and I got to review Raw and SmackDown and pay-per-views and stuff like that. Dude, it's tough to get through these shows.
The cookie cutter aspect has to be tough too. Entrances are all choreographed, and the guy, from what I see, the guys don't look as much cookie cutter as they did just like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the idea of the way they act, the way they perform, and the way they dress, and so it's still a cookie cutter mentality.
Yeah, no, it is, and like I said, you have, you know, a whole generation of fantastic athletes. But you get them on a microphone, and it's crickets.
Oh, God. Yeah, you couldn't even begin to think of doing some of the things they do athletically.
Yeah,
I would have just walked out of the building. I would have, you know, not happening. Why am I bothering? Just fire me now.
Yeah,
you know, are that level of athlete, no doubt. But as you say, they do some of that, and then you said when they for nothing.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're making the money. Oh, yeah, I know some of them are, but the rest.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's your boy, the coach from the WWE. Now, there are very few wrestling podcasts out there that I like, but this one I love. I love the name. I love the personalities. I love the content. Follow. Subscribe. I do. The Rad Turtles Wrestling Podcast. That's where you're at right here.
RTW Rewind.
There's some guys back in the day that could probably hang with the guys now, like, you know, Kurt Hennig or, you know, Shawn Michaels had a pretty good run. But, I mean, early Shawn Michaels was, you know, when he was with the Marty Jannetty, they were pretty dynamic as a tag team.
I worked with him a few nights.
Yeah. Yeah. How were they to work with?
Oh, you see, I mean, I knew both of them since I knew Shawn before he started. And then I knew Marty, like, his third match ever. So, I mean, I knew him for years before they ever went
up. Yeah, because Ken Johnson got Shawn into the business, right?
Mm-hmm. And then Marty took my place in Kansas City in 84.
Mm, okay.
So.
Yeah, Marty was pretty underrated. If he didn't have all the troubles he had, he could have had a fantastic career, man. I mean, he had a good career, but he could have had a really good run. He was just as good as Shawn.
He could have been a Shawn level.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He
never grew up. I love him. Yeah. And I thank the world of him, even with all his demons, because we have, you know, what I see out of him today, I'm just like, oh, God, why?
Yeah.
You know, the guy I knew, even though he was wild, it wasn't that. It's hard to say. You know, you want to keep some of your memories of your friends.
Shawn was that way too, though. I mean, if Shawn didn't, change his life around and get saved, he could have been in the same spot.
Yeah, Marty could have been Shawn level though. I mean, we said it a minute easily, very much so. He just couldn't get himself straight. Couldn't grow up.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, there's a lot of guys that we saw that. How were you able to avoid a lot of that? I mean, never mind.
No, let's put it this way. I didn't when I was there. At the end, when it came close to the end, I realized my day was up. Mm-hmm. I realized that when I said back when I was 18, I'm going to go back to school if this doesn't work out. That working out lasted longer than I expected, but now it was time. It was like, you know, I didn't walk in the morning. There was no money left. I mean, it was, when I say that, the money was in pretty bad shape. And when I finally decided to leave, it was the mid-aughts. It took me a couple of years to pull the trigger, so to speak, because I wanted to go out my way. We all do. Anyway, the money was horrible at that point in time. I couldn't walk. I had a son. My mom was dying. I had a son. My middle son, he was in trouble. I mean, nothing huge, but it was always something. You know, he's one of those kids, always something. Yeah. And so it became time to where it's time to go. I don't know what to do, but it's time to go. It was huge in my getting and retiring. It took me 2 years to realize it was time to go. Yeah. And then as right as I was getting ready to retire, I met my wife that I'm married to now. And she drug me dragging and screaming for a while because you quit something you've done for almost 30 years. It was your life for almost 30 years. And you have trouble letting go of all of whatever that was. Even if you've already made up in your mind. By now, I had already graduated from college, was going for my grad degree, or already go for my grad degree. Yeah, I was going for my grad by this time. So I had already started making some major moves, but there was still that, you know, you want to hang around a little bit. You want to, yeah, you know, man. And she drug me screaming and hollering. And, no, you don't have to be on the road Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You don't have to leave on Thursday and get home. Man. You can go someplace and actually have a life normal, you know. And after about 6 months of that, I just one day I realized I'm good. I've got a job at the college that I had first, you know, I graduated within in stages, an associate's, bachelor's, master's. And I had a job at the college that I had got I received my associates from. I had that. I had her. I had the boy that was he was the trouble child, my problem child.
Yeah.
I had all this in front of me, and I'm like, just keep going. Don't look back. And it's easier when you can't walk or you can't turn your neck more than about 40 degrees. You know, that it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
But that was it. I had to make up my mind. And then even once I made up my mind, it still took some prod.
Right.
And the one thing that I did that so many don't do is I made a plan, an exit strategy, and that was to go back to school. So, you know, guys like Martel and Tito, they invested before they ever got out. So they had an exit strategy before they ever got ready to exit. And me, I had to put it all together at the end. And that's the one thing I would tell anybody, have something.
Yeah, because you never know when it's gone. I mean, an injury can take you out in a second. You know, in any sport, really. I mean, basketball, football, hockey. You know, if you don't have something planned and you're living, you know, by the seat of your pants, enjoying life and living it up, you're not going to have anything when you get out.
Nope. And that's what a lot of guys. I probably should have more. I don't. I mean, I bought a house. I'm still in it at those days.
Yeah.
And that was one thing I saw so many of the guys that I'm like, the only people going to take that house is the tax man. And I'll do everything I can to keep that from happening.
Yeah.
You know, but other than that, I don't have probably what I should have.
And right.
That's our decisions. That's every last one of us that doesn't have it. That's ours. It's nobody else to blame.
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate how many people we've lost over the years. And wrestling gets a really bad rep for it. But, I mean, you can't blame the business itself. For it. You know, it's a personal decision that these guys make.
Every bit of it. Every bit of it. The lifestyle, the grind makes justifying the decisions a lot easier. I promise that it does. But at the end of the day, it's still you. You decide you're not going to take another drink, or you decide you're not going to chop out another line, or you decide I'm not going to take another pill. You decide that it's time to go home. It's you. It's nobody else.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you listen to guys like Jake Roberts, who, you know, he said he made obscene amounts of money, and, you know, he's either giving it to the women he was with, you know, or blowing up his nose, or, you know, just making poor decisions.
He's another one. You know, personally, I can't take the world at him, but yeah, there's issues there. And nobody made Jake do those things.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of guys that just couldn't adjust to life outside of wrestling, I mean, fell into, you know, similar traps. Yeah.
That's hard. And I was never at their level. I was never, you know, walked down the street, recognized everywhere I went. They type that type of notoriety, or fame, whatever word we want to use. I never had that. And it's still hard to let go. Because there is a rush, and it's an ego rush, when you can go out in front of a crowd, if it's 200 or 20,000, you can go out in front of a crowd, and you can get that reaction from them when you want the reaction from them.
Right.
That in itself is a rush, not to mention the fact that you work 2 days a week. I mean, 2 days a week, you work 2 hours a day. You may travel 4 or 5 hours or 6 hours. Some travel days are brutal.
Yeah.
But in reality, you're in the building, you're in your workplace 4 hours a day compared to 8, 10. There's so many, I don't want to say positives, but there's certainly traps that make it so much to where I just don't want to go. I don't want to let it go.
Right.
You don't want to.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, even, you know, guys like Steve Austin, it took him a good year or two just to get it out of his system. And once he did, he was fine, but there was other guys that just, they couldn't, they had no, that's all they knew was wrestling. They had no idea what to do, you know, and they felt like crap. And yeah,
that's all I knew.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a decent job as a teenager. Again, I graduated high school and I was in the ring my first time at 19. And then I was there until I was 47, almost 48.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah. And I did little things here along the way. Whenever you need to make a little extra money, a bill comes due, you know, a household appliance blows up or something like that, you need it right then. I did a few little things, but that doesn't mean I learned them. That just means I learned them. So, yeah, so for the 30 years, that's all I did. That's all I was. And I knew when I got it was time to get out, there's only one way. I mean, I'm not going to be able to physically do it because even at that point in time, I was already falling apart. So I went back to school. You know, there's so many guys that want to do things like that. I'm like, why? It's there for you.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, your wife has stuck with you all these years. So, I mean, I'm sure she helped you quite a bit.
I don't know. It's a blessing and a curse, but yeah. I don't know. If it hadn't been for her, I don't know where it'd be. Honestly.
RTW Rewind.
I read in some of my research and some of the stuff I didn't know about you. How did you get one of a few people to be licensed to be Doink the Clown? How did that start? You don't know?
You know, it's truly, in all honesty, in my last few months when I was with Vince, Doink had got so hot, the business had got so bad, that he had Doink in every town.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Three, how many towns he was running at night? Maybe two towns, maybe four, whatever. Doink would make an appearance in every town. And you would show up, and when I say you, me, or a couple of the other guys, Apollo, Lombardi.
Yep.
Another one that they did this one quite often. The outfit is on the truck. Go get the outfit. We need you to run in. You run in, run around the ring, and leave.
Right.
Something like that. And then the African promoter that I was working for at the time on occasion asked me, could I do it? You know, I had just left Vince, and I had just finished Puerto Rico. So like about 5 months after I'd left Vince. He's like, can you still do it? I hadn't even thought about doing it.
Yeah.
And Clown goes, I said, I don't know why not. I'm on the other side of the world. I might as well. Okay. You know, you're going to pay me, right? Yeah, okay. So the worst he's going to do is cease and desist in the beginning when I get off the plane coming home.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but I still got my payday for the trip. So anyway, and it just mushroomed from there. And then two or three times through the years, Vince would send word to me, you know, just don't do anything stupid, like get arrested in the office. You know, don't do anything stupid on a TV for somebody that's going to come, you know, we're going to have to shut them down. You know, just don't be stupid with the gimmick. Two or three times he sent word to me through Percy Pringle or called me one time, somebody from the office, I don't remember who it was now, and because that office changed. So,
right, yeah.
No. But like about four times down through the rest of my career when I was doing it, I would get word that just don't be dumb. Go make your money. Do your thing. Because they weren't going to bring me back. They weren't they had no spot for me. Business had changed by then. I was able to make some coin with it. And as long as I didn't get arrested. That was one of the messages I got. Don't get arrested in the outfit. So somebody had that I didn't hear about. That's the story. I mean, I've never had a piece of paper with Vince on anything.
Wow.
Nothing.
That's pretty remarkable, man. Like really, like that's you had such a good run, and you know that's not something Vince likes to do typically. I mean, he's usually controlling about his gimmicks and, you know, changing guys' names when they come in so he can own it and all that. But to let you use that gimmick just to make some money, I mean, you can say what you want about Vince. I mean, I'm sure, like you said, he's probably done some shitty things over the years. But
he's a billionaire.
Yeah, right. But, I mean, that was kind of, you know, cool of him to let you, you know, run with that for a while.
Harmony. I wasn't out there, as I say, using the gimmick on somebody's TV in order to...
That's right. You didn't go to Nitro and use Doink the Clown, right? Yeah. Right. I get it. Yeah.
I wasn't arrested face down in the snow in the gimmick, and it makes the headline of papers for 100 miles. I heard the story like 10 years later. I'm like, why did I ever get told don't get arrested in the gimmick? And so I'm not going to bother with the guest story now, but I heard the whole story. And I'm like, oh, good. Yeah. So that's it. It was just always just a tacit... approval.
Yeah. Do you still got the gear?
No.
No.
I have like two pairs of boots from all those years. And that's probably it. Mm-hmm. That's probably all I have left. Between my boys and friends or whatever, I don't have anything left.
Do you wish you would have kept some of that around? Just, no, didn't matter to you? I've heard that a lot from the guys. Like, yeah, that's good. Like, that was, you know, in my past. There's no reason to keep around and reminisce about it. You know what I mean? Like,
oh, thanks. I have my boots. But yeah. That's enough. That's
right.
Enough. Besides, I look at the gear and realize I couldn't get into it now if I tried. So
I take it you don't get the itch anymore to just maybe get back in the ring and one more time? Not at all?
Once in a while, I'll throw a joke out there with somebody about when I make the comeback or whatever. But
right.
Two back surgeries later, hip replacement later, a knee that I'm just waiting to have replaced later. No.
Wow. So even working a limited schedule, although you did pick up indie bookings, your body really took that toll, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I worked probably 4,000 matches over that time.
That's quite a bit. Yeah, that's quite a bit.
I was always full time except for like the first 6 months I was in the business.
Okay.
Unless you're related to somebody, most of us are part time. and then like the last 6 months I was in the business, I didn't care in the last 6 months or so I was in the business. I no-showed people. I showed up when I wanted to. I mean, I worked part time. But the other 28 years, I was full time and I was easily somewhere around 4,000 matches. Yeah, and I hadn't had the hip replaced. My knee will be replaced before the year's over. My neck fused itself.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
Yeah, I've had two back surgeries, and my back will always have damage. It's just going to be a series of back surgeries. It's just whenever it gets to a certain point, I can't stand it. Then they go in and they take pressure off my back again. So,
yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's hard to get around, but would you change anything that you did?
Not really. You say, well, if I hadn't have done, or if I had not this, or had I not that, but then at the same token, I'm moving because of the light behind me. By the same token, I wouldn't have ended up with four beautiful kids. I wouldn't ended up with the wife I have. I wouldn't ended up with the grandchildren I have because so much else would have changed. What's really important wouldn't be here for me today.
So, yeah, no, that's true. I mean, everything happens for a reason.
Yes. Yeah. And then I'm a firm believer in that butterfly effect or the ripple effect, whichever one you want to use, however you want to call it, whatever analogy you use. I'm a firm believer that if you change that path, it's completely different. And where I'm at today, I don't want it to be different.
Right. Yeah.
No. Everybody makes mistakes. You know, there's times where you shouldn't have gone to this town or can't do it. Can't anybody now.
Yeah, true. I mean, there's no point in living in having regrets and all that. You know what I mean? You had a good run. You had a good life. And you know, you still have a good life. And now, yeah. And now you're teaching. Like, how cool is that, man? You enjoy that?
Yeah, very much. I hate this lockdown. I really, I'm online, so I still have a job. It's not like a lockdown hurt me there. But it's just the fact that you go in and you can interact with the students.
Right.
Sit down and have conversations with them. And get to share some of those 20 some odd overseas trips that you made that mm-hmm. may have been 20 years ago, but you saw, and you can tie it in with what you're teaching today. You know, I missed some of that. And you know, the wrestling took me to all those places, so I can't regret that. And then when I say just the interaction, I love my job. I fell into a good place. You know, it's one of those things I had no clue what I was doing when I started. But then that's my whole career. I had no idea, but I'm there. I'm here. Yeah. I'll make it work somehow.
Right. I mean, you know, and a lot of those trips, you know, taught you a lot of life experiences. Yeah. And that's really cool that you can tie all that in and, you know, teach some of the younger kids now. Hey, yeah. This is how things were, you know what I mean?
It's easier in college level than it would be, say, at the public school level, because I don't have to censor quite as much, or I don't have to be quite as concerned about feelings if I say, you know, these were the actions people took.
Yeah.
Or this is the way they treated each other. So I don't have to be quite so sensitive.
Right.
Yeah.
You ever have any students come back and reconnect with you after they graduated?
Yeah, you have one every once in a while that will send you a message. It's, you know, hey, I'm doing, or I got accepted, or whatever. And so you get that on occasion, and that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I mean, that's gonna be a really good feeling to know that you had a part in shaping, you know, that person's life.
It does. It does. Which has pretty much been my whole life, you know, helping create whatever else bigger, whatever bigger there is, whatever term we want to use. That's pretty much been my life. I just facilitate.
Yeah. So we're going to wrap it up here in a second. Any good stories that you could share that may not get somebody in trouble or
I'm sure you got in trouble.
Right.
I don't know. You know, there's so many. I don't know because there was so many different situations. I'll give you when I got kicked out. My wife reminded me of one that I can tell. I went to Israel in '87 with world class, and I ended up getting kicked out of Jesus' tomb that day. We were in Jerusalem. We had gone from to Jerusalem. So we're in Jerusalem. And that same day, I watched Abdullah Butcher try to ride a camel, and the camel just laid down and spit shit. I'm done. You're not riding me. So it was a good day. Anyway, I was hanging with Buddy Roberts. You can imagine what that was like.
Yep.
We were a few in, adult beverages in. Day drinking, you know, I don't recommend it, but we were. Our tour guide says, you have to go see Jesus' tomb. And I said, wait a minute, I thought he was in the cave over on the mount. No, they have built a memorial to him in this huge church. It's Star of David. Each point is a different church, different denomination, different religion. And they have like this memorial, and it's been created as if it was Jesus's tomb. You must go see it.
Yeah.
If you say so. So I go, and Buddy Jack, this is too much. Line's too long. So I'm there by myself, and I'm like two people to go into Jesus's tomb. I'm like two away. There's like two people in front of me, and I can go. And it's about the size of, a living room, a kitchen. A small house, and I can see in. I see like a little casket and stuff and candles, but I can't. I'm not in. This little guy cuts in front of me. It just cuts line. And again, keep in mind we've been day drinking, so yeah. I'm like, "Hey, buddy, you don't cut. Especially Jesus too. We don't cut the line." He tries to know English on me. And I knew better because I had just talked to the same guy, I think, in a little shop down the street. And in old Jerusalem, the streets aren't, bicycle paths.
Yeah.
So you know when you bumped into someone, right? And I already talked to him. He speaks English. He tries to know English on me. And I keep going, hey, you don't do this. And he goes, this is Jesus sticking to the back of the line, guy. So right about that time, I just had all I could take, and I, back of the head, his glasses went off into Jesus' tomb. Next thing I know, I've got like six guys escorting me out. The machine guns. Police in Israel have machine guns. And they take me out, and Buddy was sitting on the curb with somebody, Jeff Rates, Jeep Swenson, one of the two. He was, it may have been both of them. And they're like, what'd you do to get the escort? And I said, I get a little guy in the back of the head, his glasses were flying off. Next thing you know, and they're like, oh my God, we can't be seen with you in Jerusalem. You just got kicked out. That was the kind of stuff. I never really escaped all of, I didn't have the multi-million-dollar lawsuits and stuff, but I had things happen. A lot of the guys, you hear stories. I had some of that stuff go on. So.
Man, you went all that way, and after all that, you didn't get to go.
Yeah, I literally my foot was almost in the door to go into the, and they're like, you got to go, and they have the guns on me, and I'm like, I'm going to argue with 4, 5, 6 machine guns. I'm leaving. I'm going. And then I got drunk Buddy Roberts, and I can't be seen with you. You got kicked out of Jesus. I'm in Jerusalem trying to find my way out of Jerusalem. Yeah, things like that. That was our life, though. Things like Bart, we would torture Bart. By Bart, we would torture. Yeah. Oh my God, he's a good-hearted guy, but we would just torture him. Like one night, he brought in some It was Sportatorium when Crockett was running the Sportatorium. Mm-hmm. And he brought in a bag of chicken, and he's like, guys, help yourselves. Okay, we did. Me, Murdoch, Johnny Hawk, Brad Layfield.
Yep.
And we ate it all. Oh, he went off. He went screaming at Bar how he ate all his chicken, and you know, just little things like that. That was every day. Those were minor. That's nowhere near the stuff like guys cutting legs off of pants and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, I was there the night Russo hit Dynamite in the Mouth. I mean, I come right around. I didn't see it happen, but I come around the corner right after that.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, the level of my stuff and the level of things like that, I mean, it just. I'm glad I didn't quite ever graduate to that level, I guess.
What was one of the funniest ribs that you were, you witnessed?
Gypsy Joe hated snakes. Gypsy Joe from Tennessee.
I live in Tennessee now. I grew up in Connecticut, but my father-in-law talks about Gypsy Joe quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So.
Okay. So you know who he'll know who's that I'm talking about. And Kansas City was like his last territory. And we were 85. And the Kansas City building, the showers had the long showers, and the wall between the showers and the dressing room didn't go all the way up. And I had just found out Joe was scared of snakes. So I had a plastic snake, and I threw it over that wall, and he was in the shower with some young kid that had just, like, his first match ever. And I threw that snake, and when that snake hit the ground, Rufus was sitting next to me, Rufus R. Jones.
Yeah.
He yelled, Joe, snake! And next thing I know, he started beating the hell out of that kid in the shower. Yeah, the guy got out. It was Kansas City in January. The guy got out, put a pair of pants on, and left. I don't even know if he took his bag. We never told Joe it was us.
Oh, man. Oh, that poor kid, man.
But, you know, that was one of the funniest things ever. It was like, oh, my God, he's killing that kid. And, yeah, you know, we did things like that. We, like I say, we did super glue a few shoes in our day.
nothing too mean spirit, like no ribbing on the square and stuff like that.
Yeah, we weren't super glue. Other guys did super glue the Halliburton shot. Oh, yeah. The goddamn Dynamite, his favorite thing was if you left your Halliburton open, he knew how to change the combination.
Mm.
So he would change the combination without it, and then you would go and you would lock it. And when you get to the room or you'd get home or wherever you were headed, you couldn't open your own Halliburton.
Yeah, that sucks.
He did that all kinds of, yeah, he was bad. I saw him do it more than once.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Orndorff told a great story about somebody messing with his new bag that he bought. And, you know, it's just there's some things that he had a gun, too. And, I mean, he wanted to kill the guy.
Well, the old timers carried guns. Yeah. That's what people don't understand, especially the hills. They carried guns because sometimes that's how they got out of the building. They pulled them on each other, too. Now, the guys were pulling them on each other. The whole purpose, the whole idea, the whole theory was, I don't know if I'm going to get out of the building tonight. I've actually had my partner in Puerto Rico pull the gun to get us out of a building one time. So
I heard Puerto Rico was pretty insane.
I also had a promoter in South Africa shoot a man to get us out of a building one night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was not leaving. It was him and his two buddies. And he was strapped. You know, people in South Africa are strapped, quite a few of them, everywhere they go. And it was one of those things where we have to go that way to get out of the building, and we are not leaving. And boom, winged him. He made sure he didn't kill him, but I was standing right there. I was like a little girl in the moment, like, oh, my God, screaming and hiding behind him. And
that's pretty crazy. I mean, you hear, you know, stories like Piper used to tell of, you know, getting stabbed and getting guns pulled on him, too. And he was so great at getting heat, people thought it was real. They wanted to kill him. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was a different time back then.
Three times. I've been stabbed two or three times.
Have you really?
Yeah.
No kidding. Wow. Yeah.
Not in the States. Not in the States. It's always been a country. Yeah. Here in the States, I've only seen, like, one riot in the last – well, I haven't been in business in 10 years. But prior to leaving – I hadn't seen a legitimate riot in the States since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Overseas, I had more than I've been in more than one. Jeez.
Yeah.
I've been stabbed like three different times.
I can't imagine that. I can't imagine somebody being that upset at wrestler or anything, really, to want to stab somebody.
You did your job. You did well. You did your job.
Right, yeah.
We had one ride in South Africa where I took a chair on top of the head and I ended up losing teeth. And that was from the fans. I wasn't,
Oh, Jesus. That's crazy, man. Back when kayfabe was still around, right?
Yeah, and even in these days, Vince had, by now, Vince had already started exposing everything, and you still... People just go, they get to drink it. It's like they did in the old days. Get to drink it, and they want to believe. They have no idea how dangerous it could be. And in those days weren't as dangerous for me as it had been for the guys just 10, 15 years before.
True.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Well, hey, man, it was really, really good talking to you. There's so much more I can ask you, but I won't keep you too much longer. But is there anything you want to plug, anything you got going on, or can people find you on social media?
Yeah, I'm on social media, Facebook, Twitter too, Rancho Wolf on Twitter. Then we've got to be out. There's a book. I wrote a book a few years ago, perspective of a guy like me that was never pushed, but was never out of work either. Journeyman. That's what it was. Journal of Journeyman. That's out there on Amazon. I have no idea what it's selling for anymore. But it's out there. I know it's out there. And like I say, Twitter, Facebook, I can be found in both places.
Well, good stuff, man. Again, I completely appreciate you working with me and taking time out of your schedule. I know you're a busy guy. And
I'm like about 1,047 days in lockdown. But the last week was busy because I had all my finals and so on and had to grade all that before I could get it in. But, I'm at home, so we're good.
Well, again, man, it was fun talking to you. I had a blast. I love always catch up with guys and listen to stories I never heard before. And like I said, I respect everybody that ever walked into business and laced up their boots. And whether you're Hulk Hogan or whether you're yourself or Barry or the enhancement guys had just in fact had a greater purpose, to be quite honest, by making everybody else look good.
You weren't going to have a star without us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So.
Because they can't make each other.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, I appreciate you being here, man. It really means a lot.
Yeah, appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
RTW Rewind.
Well, guys, I hope you enjoyed that interview with former WWF, WCW, former professional wrestler, enhancement guy, Dusty Wolf. People give him a negative connotation about being a jobber, which I didn't bring up at all because it's disrespectful. I didn't really want to call him a jobber or a job guy, but the PC term now is enhancing talent. But man, what a great guy! Great stories. I had such a blast talking to Dusty. Such an entertaining guy, and we'll have to go back again and talk to some more. Talk about more stories because I know he's got a million stories to get into about working with some of the best talent that we've ever seen in the history of the wrestling business. And guys like Dusty put those guys over, whether it was shining up the baby faces or getting squashed by the heels. He was there and did his job and did his purpose, and he did it very, very well. So I had such a good time talking to Dusty. Thank you, Dusty, for coming on the show, brother. If you guys want to follow me on Twitter, it is at RadRobGaming. I'm a Twitch gaming streamer. You can follow me on twitch.tv/RadRobGaming, streaming every Tuesday night, 6 p.m. Central, and every Sunday afternoon at 2 in the afternoon. And also, check out my YouTube gaming page. It is RadRobGaming. If you want to follow the show on Twitter, we are at RadTurtlesPOD. Send us an email, RadTurtlesWrestling@gmail.com, Facebook.com/RadTurtlesWrestling. Please leave us a like there. And check out our company website for the Reality Check Podcast Network. It is RCPodNetwork.com. I hope you enjoyed this interview with the one and only Dusty Wolf, and I'll be right back here on Thursday for another edition of RTW Rewind. Until then, guys, thanks for listening. Be safe, be well, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. You can follow RTW on Twitter at Rad Turtles Pod, and you can email the show at RadTurtlesWrestling@gmail.com. We appreciate all of your support. You've been listening to RTW Rewind, exclusively here on the R&R Podcast Network.